Welcome to The Lay Disciple, the ministry of Truth Seekers Fellowship of Memphis. We're in a new series of lessons on the life of Christ and laying the important foundation for deeper understanding. Today, Tom Murray will talk about the Memra and make sure that we have a good understanding of important biblical definitions. Keep listening.
Well, I welcome you back to the broadcast, and today we're going to pick up with what the Jewish rabbis over the centuries before the advent of Christ were doing with that word. They had developed that word, the Aramaic, Memra, and we looked at the first three theological conclusions that they'd reach. Number four, the rabbis taught, was that the Memra was the means or the agent of revelation. In Ezekiel 1:3, the word, Aramaic Memra, provided God's revelation to his prophet Ezekiel. Fifthly, the Memra was the agent of creation. Psalms 33:6 says, "By the word, the Memra of the Lord Jehovah, were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth." Sixthly, the rabbis taught that the Memra was the agent of the theophany. Now, a theophany is the visible manifestation of God's omnipresence, or the Shekinah glory when it became visible. Now, based upon those 7 points that the rabbis came to conclude during the Old Testament period about the Memra, we can now ask the question, what does all this have to do and how does it relate to John's introduction in his gospel account, his prologue in John 1, 1-18? Well, John is simply saying in John 1, 1-18, that everything the rabbis said about the Memra, or the Word, is true of Jesus Christ. Let's do that. In verse 1, in John 1:1, it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." So in this verse, John is stating that Jesus fulfills the 6th point that the rabbis taught about the Memra. Jesus was the same as God, but sometimes Jesus was distinct from God. Then secondly, in John 1:3, he says, "All things were made by him." So John is making the point that Jesus fulfills the 5th point that the rabbis taught about the Memra. Jesus was the agent of creation. Thirdly, in John 1, verses 3 to 4, the use of the word him proves that Jesus fulfills the 1st point that the rabbis taught about the Memra. Jesus was a person. And then in John 1:14, John says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father." John is making the point that Jesus fulfills the 7th point that the rabbis taught about the Memra. Jesus was the visible manifestation of the Shekinah glory of God. Then in John 1:17, John says, "For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." John is making the point that Jesus fulfills the 2nd point that the rabbis taught about the Memra. Jesus was the agent of the new covenant of grace. And then in verse 18 of chapter 1, John says, "No man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him." Now, John is making the point that Jesus fulfilled the 4th point that the rabbis taught about the Memra. Jesus was the agent of revelation. He revealed the Father. Then in John chapter 1, verse 12, he said, "But as many as received him, to them he gave the power to become the sons of God." So John is making the point that Jesus fulfills the 3rd point that the rabbis taught about the Memra, that Jesus was the agent of salvation. So everything that the Mimrah taught about the rabbis taught about the Mimrah, John is saying all those things are true of Jesus Christ. What John is saying in his prologue or introduction to his gospel account is not in conformity with Greek philosophy of his day, but it is very much in conformity with the Jewish theology of his day. Now, even though John wrote his gospel in the Greek language and used the Greek word logos to introduce Jesus, John was not thinking about what the Greek word logos meant to the Greek mind or to Greek philosophy. John was thinking about the word Mimrah and what it meant to Jewish minds and Jewish theology. Understanding this important point will help you understand exactly what John was saying in his introduction about Jesus. Now, many commentaries that I've looked at on John's introduction in chapter 1, 1 to 18, attempt to explain what John is saying by using the Greek understanding of the word logos. But that approach will not give you a clear presentation of what John is actually saying regarding Jesus. It will not give you the same understanding that would result from a clear understanding of the Jewish perspective taught by the rabbis in the Old Testament period up to John's day regarding the issue of the Mimrah. Now, that's going to bring us then to what we want to talk about, and that is the genealogy of the king that John wants to introduce you to when he begins to talk about the actual arrival of the king onto the scene at the beginning of his public ministry. Now, to find that, you're going to find that in John's account, and you'll also find it in the Matthew account, and also you'll find it in Luke. And what we have in the genealogy of the king to know is that only two of the gospel writers actually give us an account of the early life of Christ. And I have told you something wrong in that John does not deal with the genealogy of the king or Christ. He actually doesn't deal with that. He skips it. But the two writers who do deal with it are Matthew and Luke. Now, Matthew gives the account and the circumstances concerning Jesus Christ. But when Matthew, who is writing to Jews, gives the genealogy of Christ, he will give it from Joseph's perspective and not from Mary's. So what we are given in Matthew's side of the story is Joseph's side. Now, in Joseph's side, or in Joseph's genealogy, Matthew will tell us that the angel came to Joseph, and that Joseph did this and Joseph did that. Now, in Matthew's account, Mary plays a very passive role in what Matthew has to say about the genealogy of the king. Now, in Luke's gospel, it's just the opposite. If you remember, Luke tells us the story from Mary's perspective. Mary's genealogy is what Luke gives in the Luke account. And in that account, you'll find that the angel comes not to Joseph, but to Mary. And it is Joseph now, in Luke's account, who will play a very passive role. So what we have in the New Testament in the four Gospels are two accounts. One genealogy from Joseph's perspective recorded by Matthew, and one genealogy recorded by Luke from Mary's perspective. Now, we have these two genealogies, and the reason we have two genealogies in our New Testament is because of the Old Testament requirement for kingship. In the Old Testament, there are two requirements for kingship. Now, one is applicable to the southern kingdom of Judah, with its capital in Jerusalem, and the other is applicable to the northern kingdom of Israel with its capital in Samaria. You'll remember that after Solomon died, the kingdom of Israel was divided into the 10 northern tribes and called Israel, and the 2 southern tribes, which were known as Judah. Now, in subsequent history, down to the time of Christ, there were kings who sat on the thrones, both in the northern and in the southern kingdom. Now, the requirement for the kingship, according to one commandment, was that the king had to be from the line of David. Now, that was the requirement of the southern kingdom of Judah with its capital in Jerusalem. Now, anyone who was not from David's line of descent could not sit upon the throne of Judah in Jerusalem. Now, if there were any conspiring parties to try to wipe out the house of David, that's exactly what happened in an account recorded for you in Isaiah chapter 7. Any such conspiracy was doomed to failure, according to what Isaiah said in chapter 8. Now, the second requirement for kingship was applicable to the northern kingdom, and that was that it required divine appointment, or it needed prophetic sanction. That is, no one could sit upon the throne of the northern kingdom in Samaria unless he had divine appointment or prophetic sanction by prophets. And anyone who tried to get the throne apart from those two requirements was always assassinated in the history of the northern kingdom. So the prophet says to Jehu in 2 Kings 15:12, "Your house will sit upon the throne of Samaria for 4 generations." And when the 5th man tried to gain that throne, he was assassinated. So Matthew, in his genealogy account, comes from Joseph, and Matthew will break Jewish custom by naming the names of women in his genealogical account. But you'll also find that Matthew breaks Jewish custom by skipping names. Now, the purpose of Matthew's genealogy is to show that if Jesus really was Joseph's son, Jesus could not be the king of the Jews. Now, if you'll come back in our next broadcast, we're going to look through Matthew and then Luke and find out why Matthew wrote the way he wrote. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he was creating a problem for Jewish minds so he could solve it in Jesus Christ. And I want you to understand that truth as well. See you next time.
Thank you, Tom. If you'd like to be a serious disciple of Christ, then you'll want to begin a deeper study in His Word. And I can't think of a better way than to attend one of Tom Murray's discipleship classes. For more information or to order today's tape, call us at Truth Seekers Fellowship. That number is 901-685-3385. Or you can visit us on the web at www.truthseekersfellowship.org. Now make plans to join us again next time for The Lay Disciple.